For today's focus, we head to Iraq, where the military, supported by the US and French air forces, has gained control of two more areas in the east of Mosul. While the army now has its sights firmly set on the city's western neighborhoods, some of which remain firmly in the clutches of the Islamic State group. While the task isn't an easy one, the IS have become experts at booby-trapping everyday objects, leaving behind explosive devices everywhere.
French special forces are side by side with elite Iraqi soldiers. Their mission? Gather intelligence by finding and analyzing explosives left behind by the Islamic State group.
Lors de l'explosion de la charge, les billes sont projetées à très grande vitesse.
They're never far from the front lines. The French are helping to identify targets.
It's complicated. There are areas where we know there are very few civilians, but we have to be absolutely sure.
Their goal? To see without being seen. 200 strong on the ground, they remain anonymous.
Ils ont pas ça en face.
J'espère pas.
For the past 2 years, French soldiers have been discreetly training, supporting, and advising Iraqis and Kurds.
Right there, it says, watch out for jets. It means there were coalition fighter jets flying over this place.
By following electric cabling, the French soldiers stumble upon a strategic hideout once used by a sniper. Just a bed and openings from which to fire on Iraqi forces. The door leading outside might be booby-trapped. The demining expert opens it carefully.
Le balcon par à gauche, vous voyez qu'il y a des traces de pas au sol. Ok, je pars à droite.
The jihadists have become fearsome experts at booby trapping. They put explosives into all kinds of everyday objects.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a very special guest on with me today, Raymond. And Raymond served in the French Army for a number of years in the French Special Forces. So it's great to have you on, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing great. First of all, I'm really happy to be part of your podcast. And I really appreciate it, sir. And the second thing, I want to say hi to everybody who listened to your program. And English is not my mother tongue, you know, but so forgive me if I make a mistake on my sentence and or I don't know. So,
no, that's French. Cool, man.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
So you were with the French SAS, Special Air Service. You know, the SAS is one of the more famous counterterrorism units in the world for some of the work they've done over the years. Can we talk about some of the history of the unit, like when it started and some of the things
yes,
it was
sir.
Doing in the beginning?
Sure. Actually, it's not a Special Air Service. It's a STIC Action Special. Okay?
I see.
Yeah, it's not the Special Air Service as people call the SAS, British SAS. Where my unit come from, it's from the same thing as the SAS back in 1940, you know. There is this guy, the Captain Berger. He went to England and was trained by the SAS and came back in the French occupied. The France occupied, and to fight with the free French against the German, of course. And that's how my unit started.
Right, so basically it was in occupied France, and basically you're doing guerrilla warfare, essentially.
Yes. So these guys were trained in England with the SAs, and they came back to France. They are dropped in France to do like a special action to hurt the Nazi.
Right. Okay. So can we talk a little bit about you and what motivated you to join the French army, and then maybe if we can walk through your career a little bit?
Yes, sir. Of course. I grew up in Madagascar. My family have been in Madagascar for many generations. But I have different roots. Actually, I have like 31 DNA. So I feel like I belong to Madagascar, but everywhere I go, I feel home. It's very funny as a feeling, you know, when I work through all these years. So I come back to my roots. I grew up in Madagascar. My family are 6 kids. I'm the last boy in my family. Everybody in my family always thought that I was the baby still today after all my career, but that's okay. So I grew up in Madagascar, and I grew up in, like, you know, we call it Madagascar, California, where people can surf, you know, on the ocean. And I was Rasta. I grew up as Rasta in my head. I think like the Rastafari people.
Yeah.
But someday it's turned that my sister married somebody who really mistreated her, you know, was really bad to my sister. So when I was like 19, my mom told me, you need to move to France. By the way, I'm a French citizen. You know, my mom is French. She said, you need to help your sister. She's not doing good, you know. So I show up to my family. I'm to my sister's apartment, and found out that she married somebody that who beat her every day, every single day. So my plan was not at all to stay in France, just like staying for a few weeks, like, you know, taking care of my sister and coming back, doing what I like to do, you know. And I found out that she was so bad, and she lost her job. She had 2 kids. And I said, I can't just leave, you know. So the guy came in the house and we had the fight, you know. I knocked him out. And then I realized that I have to do something for my sister. Back these days, these years, being black in France is really tough, you know, when you try to find a job, when you try to find like an apartment to live, you know, it's really hard. So I told my sister, I said, I will find something to help you out, because she had nothing in her apartment, not even a spot to sleep. She was sleeping on the ground when I arrived. The guy sold everything. Actually, he was a crazy guy. And I told her, I will find something for you. So I went out, tried to find a job, you know. First week, nothing. You know, it's really, really, really hard. And one day I was sitting in a town called Toulouse, south of France. I was sitting in a bench and I saw this Foreign Legion commercial saying, join us and we're going to get money in a few days. So I'm like, oh, shit, that's really good. I can make money for a few days and just, you know, roll away, you know, just to come back home. So I went to the Foreign Legion recruiter. And the guy said, he saw my hair. I was skinny guy, you know, really skinny. I was like 57 kilos. It's really light. And I was skinny, long hair, you know, surfer hair. And he's like, dude, you know what? This is not for you. I'm like, what? He said, this is not for you. You go back home, do your thing, you know. I'm like, sir, I've never felt anything I've been doing. He said, this is not for you. So go back home, come back tomorrow morning if you really want to join us. And I went back home and thinking all night, I'm like, what I'm going to do? I said, I really need this money. So in the morning, I show up to the Foreign Legion recruiter. And he was a Spanish guy called Lopez. I still remember his name. He was huge, like big guy, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, you realize that once you're saying, you're going to cut your hair. I'm like, that's okay. And you won't see your family for a few months. I said, that's okay. You're going to change your name. I said, that's okay. And he said, you will belong to us. I'm like, what? He said, yes. Once you come in the Legion, we are your family. I said, that's okay. Sir, I really need money, so I have to do this. So I signed the contract. Once I signed the contract, he started to scream like a crazy dude, you know. I was scared shitless, seriously. And he parked us in this little studio who belongs to the Foreign Legion. And inside there, there's like seven guys from the East. Big guy, you know. Everybody have I'm sure they had testosterone and everything, you know. So he said, this is the place where we're going to sleep tonight. And look, tomorrow we are going to Marseille, where there is the main headquarter of Foreign Legion. So I'm like, okay. And then I was in. I mean, I signed my contract, you know. So I start by the Foreign Legion. It's a long story. Once I finished my basic training in the Foreign Legion, I had my brother who had, he was very sick, you know, got in a coma, almost dying. So
he was in France or he was in Africa?
Yeah, he was in Madagascar.
Okay.
So I went to see my drill instructor. I said, sir, I need to go back to my country. My brother is dying. I can't stay here. I'm not focused, you know, I need to do something. So he said, listen, you need to finish the basic training. And in the end, we're going to send you to Madagascar. You're going to have 10 days off. So I did my basic training. It's like crazy. Foreign Legion training is like every day. It's a challenge, you know, every day is a challenge. Every day you are like, I want to go home. So I finished my class and I was about to go. I chose the second Foreign Legion regiment, paratrooper, which is like the best Foreign Legion regiment. And when I went to see my the captain, he said, look, you can't send you to Madagascar. I said, why, sir? He said, you are under a fake name, and we can't do any passport for you, so you are stuck here. And I know that they can do something, but they didn't want to do something for me. So they just let me see my brother. And my brother was dying. So I said, look, if you don't let me go to see my brother, I will run away. You know, it was a crazy story, run away. But I've never thought about running away. This is not me, okay? And they put me in a jail. Like 3 months, I was locked up. I have to paint all these buildings every morning. I start from 6 to 10 p.m., 6 a.m., 10 p.m. every day. And I was lucky because one of the paint, the guy who painted with me, he was like staff sergeant, and he said, you can go to the gym and you come back after your gym. So in the morning, I go to the gym and come back and do my painting. And after a few months, like 2 months, the guy said, you know what? I think you are a crazy dude. If you just sign the contract that you have, you are going back to the regiment, you're going to stop to paint here. I said, I'm going to paint until they let me go see my brother. And so they let me out, you know, they gave me the paper. And he said, never tell people that you know what is the Foreign Legion. I said, sir, I exactly know what the Foreign Legion is. So I left, you know, I left the Foreign Legion and I come back to my parents' house and, you know, take care of my brother. And I'm lucky he didn't die. He joined even the military. He's still active duty right now. Oh. He served in an airborne unit too. So from there, I really like the Foreign Legion thing. So I said, I need to go to another regiment. So I signed up for the 8th Airborne, you know. That's how I start. That's back 2000. I joined the 8th Airborne, and I spent 6 years there. And I was like, I was sniper for many years. And I end up being a platoon leader, you know.
And during, and from the, during your time there, did you deploy during those years? Like into combat?
I was deployed three times. I did the deployment in Ivory Coast during the war. You know, I stayed 6 months there. I was deployed in Central Africa. There is a putsch, so I had to go there to evacuate all the French citizens. And I was deployed in Gabon. So it's our like our base where we are deployed from Africa, in Africa, and then from there we can intervene everywhere.
Right.
So yeah, it was the Etherborn is like Foreign Legion, same thing, you know, just the beret was changing the color, which is green for the Legion, Foreign Legion, and red for us. So I spent 6 years there. It was nice. It was nice. But someday, I was watching this base where there is a huge operation coming in Africa. Like the French have to do something in one spot. And all the special force guy came with their helos, all the vehicle, all their weapons. And I've seen like people waking up in the morning going surfing. I'm like, shit, what? What the hell going on here? All these guys are like surfer, you know, they're like really chill.
Yeah.
But then in the afternoon, they're training, they go to the gym, and I see like a big guy, you know, really tough. I'm like, what are you guys? Who you are? The guy said, oh, well, you're a special force guy. Welcome, son. And he said, yeah, we are deployed here, and we're going to do like a few missions for a few months here and then go back home. I'm like, there is a way I can do your job? He said, you really want to do my job? I said, sure. I said, I want to try. He said, you are young. I was 21 years old. 21 years old. And the guy told me, listen, he said, if you want to join the special force, you need to train a lot. So from that day, I train, I run a lot. I run a lot, push up, pull up, swimming, you know.
And this is all training for selection.
Yeah. And I apply for the selection. So we were 300 people. For that year, that was 2005. And there is 63 spot, you know. So there is 300 people for 63 spot. And 3 weeks before that, I was hit by a car. That's a crazy story. I was hit by a car on the street, so I was really, really bad. You know, my back hurts. And I'm like, I won't make this. You know, it's too hard for me. It's going to be too hard, you know. My back was hurting. But a friend of mine said, man, if you don't do this, you already fucked up here. Because once you apply for the special force, if you don't success, you become the toy of everybody, you know what I mean?
Right, like I see what you mean, like a
joke. So I didn't have a choice. Yeah, I didn't have a choice. So I said, I'm going to do this. So I did the 2 weeks of special force test, you know, and I made it. I was selected. We were 62 guys selected. And then we start the basic training. It's about 1 year. And then you do your specialties.
So you do like one year of you know, marksmanship and things like that, and then you go into your specialty.
Yeah. So after the 1 year, you are sent to your first, first team. But it's like a basic team. There is no specialties. So the other team you have, so there is four companies, you know, four companies. First company specialized in the water, like
maritime type of stuff.
With the boat and the patrol boat and specialized in the hill, high altitude, high opening, you know. And we have one counter-terrorism team. We have one sniper team. We have one recon team. We have two hello team. And that's it. That's it. So every company have almost same thing, you know?
Yeah.
So when once you finish your basic training, they put you in the team where you're gonna continue to be trained, and then you're gonna choose your specialty if you wanna be a sniper, if you wanna be counterterrorism. But the word counterterrorism is really, really faking the words, because everybody does counterterrorism, right?
Right.
Yeah. So basically, all the team can be sent anywhere to do counterterrorism, but then in each company, you have a team specialist, like a hostage rescue or HVT, taking out an HVT, you know.
Right.
So that's it.
Right. So how long were you in this unit after you made it through and got into the team?
13 years. 13 years.
And you served for a total of 19?
Sorry?
You served 19 for years. 19 years. Okay.
Yes, 19 years, yeah.
So there were, you know, several incidents that made it to, you know, the news and things like that across Africa involving hostage situations, hostage rescue, or situations where an American special operations team needed assistance and the French sent helicopters and things like that. You also have experience working with American units, right?
Yes, sir. I had worked full time with U.S. Special Forces. I had worked with the Green Berets, 3rd Airborne, you know?
3rd Group, yeah.
The 3rd Group, yeah. That was in Afghanistan. I worked with the Delta Force, you know, the CAG.
Yeah.
So it was like I didn't work with them directly, but we were in the same spot where we did a huge operation, and they come to support us because it was the spot was really far in the desert, and we end up doing our operation. When you're done with it, we didn't have water anymore. So the U.S. Special Force came and give us support and stayed with us to secure the zone before we get pulled back by the choppers.
So also in that unit, when a team is on a counterterrorism status, does that involve hostage rescue and things like that?
Yes, sir. We basically my unit are one of the most used to do like all this hostage rescue or capture, HVT capture.
Right.
Yeah. And these guys are still doing great job right now, you know. I've been out from the operational for 2 years before I retired, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to prepare my retirement, but my friend is still working, doing great job, you know, backing up the country.
So that, you know, with this French, the French Special Forces, I feel like, you know, being an American, one of the more famous unit or unit that you hear about is the Foreign Legion. But the Foreign Legion is kind of a unique unit because they accept people from other countries, right?
Yeah. I think the Foreign Legion have the more than 184 citizenship, but we are not playing in the same ground at all. You know,
right.
There is a good thing when you don't know anything about a unit. That means they're doing great thing. Not right. talking about them, but I mean, the French Special Forces need to talk more about them, definitely, for two reasons. Because they're doing great job, you know, and to make the young French guy have more interesting joining right. the Special Forces.
Right, you know? To be inspired, right.
Yeah, so if you compare the Foreign Legion with the Special Force, it's like comparing the U.S. Marine with the Delta Force.
Right.
Same thing.
Right, just different so, different roles and things like that.
Yeah, there's different thing. We don't get orders from the same command, you know. We get orders from the special person command, orders directly and through the president. So it's completely different.
Right. So you know, with France having the status that it does in the world and the influence, the French government is involved in a lot of counterterrorism stuff. You guys have dealt with terrorism in the past, and you know, even within the last couple of years, you know, the attack in Paris by members of ISIS. How has some of that changed, like in the country? Because obviously you've been dealing with that kind of thing for a long time, but now, you know, the attacks are happening in France. There was one in Paris. I believe a schoolgirl or two schoolgirls were killed in Marseille, you know, within the last 4 years or so. Before we hear back from Raymond regarding the effects of terrorism in France, I would like to talk to you about the sponsor for this week's episode, Blinkist. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn more. A lot of people work and have a side gig or work two jobs, or they have to take care of the family when they get home from work. So you feel like you don't have enough time to sit down and relax and read and develop yourself. Well, there's an app that I highly recommend. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and it basically condenses them down into just 15 minutes so you can read it or you can listen to it. Blinkist is made for people like you who want to get the main talking points of the book quickly without having to sit and spend the time reading the entire book. With the audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy you can finish 4 books in a day. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health, and to history books. I like Blinkist because in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I have a better and more well-informed opinion on the topic. I use Blinkist when I'm making breakfast in the morning before I start my day, or when I'm ending my day at night. I like to read and learn, and I think that helps me fall asleep. I've read and listened to these books, and I highly recommend you check them out. The first book is The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. The second book is called Factfulness, 10 Reasons We're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think by Von Harris Rosling, Ola Rosling, Anna Rosling Runland. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/recon to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/recon to start your free 7-day trial. Now we'll get back to the conversation with Raymond regarding the effects of terrorist attacks in France.
Yeah. I mean, these kind of things change the country, you know? Right now, even myself, I don't feel like safe walking in Paris, you know, for two reasons, because I can't carry guns.
Right.
And when I was special ops for many years, I carry guns for many years. I was specialized in close protection also. So I have been protecting like ambassadors, you know, officials, generals, you know. So I always have a gun overseas. And when I come back in my country, I'm not allowed to carry a gun. And it's really frustrating.
Yeah.
So the climate right now in France is very, very bad. It's very bad. But we need to stand together against the terrorism for sure.
Right.
Because it's a disease.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that, like, people on the outside, regular civilians, people don't understand how connected terrorism is and how these different groups, you know, from Africa to Southeast Asia, Middle East, how they're, a lot of them are connected and they train and send weapons and send people to different areas to fight and things like that.
Yes. Yeah, sure. The French people discover the terrorism, the face of the terrorism. It's brand new, you know?
Yeah.
So people start to open their mind and start to realize that it's here. It's not anymore like a dream or a story. It's real right now.
Right. It's hitting home. And I think September 11th, that happened for a lot of the world, but also, you know, especially here in the United States, where people, I feel like there was a false sense of security and people just felt like things like that couldn't happen here. And then when it did, it kind of woke everybody up to reality and it changed the way we did things, you know?
Yeah, like that. I would call it, you know, it's like being raped, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you never expected it. You always say it. It's never me, always the other people.
Right.
And then you are defenseless and you have something happening in your country and you're like, oh my God, this is it. It's really here. And we are in a very bad situation. So sure.
Yeah. And I think also I was in Paris in 2018,
yeah.
And I saw firsthand, you know, once I left the airport, we got on the metro,
yeah.
And in the first stop, there was this kid from Syria, and he was just going up and down the train car, and he was handing out these little like index cards, and on the cards he wrote, you know, my name is so and so, and I'm a refugee from Syria, and I need money, basically. And yeah. I saw it all over Paris, like signs that refugees had a, you know, escaped from a war zone and went to France.
Yeah, I mean, people try to, we should not try to mix everything. You know, when I work overseas, you know, the place where people are really kind and give you hospitalities.
Right.
It's in Middle East people, you know, it's crazy. So the face that these people show here in Europe, it's not the same face that I have seen in some spot. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's really confusing. But I can do the part. I know. I mean, I don't care about people's color, people's religions.
Right.
I don't like bad guys. That's it.
Yeah, bad behavior, right?
Yeah, yes, sir. That's it. So we need really to work on that, on everybody, because I lived in a country where they say that they are like the mother of the democracy, you know, like it's the spot where democracy is really, really good, but I experience racism every day.
Right.
Even as a soldier. And I always need to prove everything all the time to be French.
Right.
And it's bittersweet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it was the French soccer team. I forget if it was for the World Cup or what it was for, but there was a big tournament.
Yeah, World Cup. Yeah, World Cup.
And there was an issue, I think, with one or two of the black players on the team that when they were winning, they were considered French. When they lost, they were Africans. So something like that, right?
This is not new. This is not new. This is always been like that. You know, you are the good French, the good colored people are French when they're good. And once they are not good, they're not French. They are called by their
their
roots.
Right. So when I was in Paris, I noticed, like, I was at Notre Dame and just even just walking through the city in different areas of the city, there was heavy police presence and or even army. I'm not exactly sure, you know, where these guys belong to, but, you know, they had their vests and their rifles and their pistols and things like that. And I guess that's just the newer reality of having to counter terrorism at home in Paris.
Yeah. I mean, I think even before we only had that, we started to have that after 9/11.
Yeah.
They started to put soldiers in the airport, you know, everywhere, in front of synagogues. But people really realized it in 2015 when these guys enter in a radio and start to shoot everybody.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it started. But as a special ops guy, we know that we have been dealing with it for many years, not just right now.
Right, exactly.
But the difference is it was not in our soil.
Yeah, there was, I think maybe it was in 2013 or something. I forget exactly the date, but where there were three American service members on a train.
And yeah.
So I had one of the guys on the podcast before.
Nice.
And I forget exactly. I think maybe they were heading to Amsterdam or something like that. And
no, they're heading to Belgium.
Belgium, right.
Yeah. And these guys saved a lot of lives, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and it just goes to show, you know, how connected we are against this threat of terrorism, you know, and it affects everybody. And I've actually done that train ride from France to from Paris to Belgium, Belgium to Amsterdam, and then back. And you know, usually those rides are, it's a nice train, it's comfortable, it's quiet. You can eat, the bathrooms are nice, things like that. And then out of nowhere, you know, a guy has an AK-47 and he's trying to kill everybody on the train.
Yeah. And the biggest mistake in Europe, some people still believe that you can fight AK-47 with a flower. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I'm not a crazy guy. I mean, I love guns. I own guns, yeah. I have the permit to carry and to detain where I'm living right now. I feel really comfortable. I'm really happy. And we should make a law for people. Like, can you imagine, like, all the U.S. Special Force guy working for 20 years in the military as a Special Ops guy retiring in America and not allowed to have guns or anything?
You know what I mean? That's crazy.
So that's crazy. And they're going to give guns to a cop who may shoot like 20 bullets a year.
Yeah, we have very little training, yeah.
Yeah. So we are not winning that side because a lot of people don't even understand what is a gun. You know, like in France, you can't buy an meal. You need to make like a crazy training and blah, blah, blah to have 9mm. But then you can buy like a 300 Winchester with a scope. So the guy sitting on his chair doing all these rules have no clue what his guns is.
Right.
You know? So it's crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You can show up in a shop,
buy a shotgun, and going back home with a shotgun. But shotgun can kill more people. I mean, it's crazy if you can see the ballistics, all the the bullets you can use with a shotgun, it's deadly.
Right.
Maybe it's more deadly than a 9mm.
Yeah, you know, that's one thing I've noticed over the years is that there are a certain number of special operations units that are not, or personnel from those units that are not American, from allied units, nations, mostly European. And when sometimes the guys, when they retire, they move to the U.S. and they're able to continue, shooting how they want to shoot, or maybe working in security or training and things like that.
Yeah. So this is what yesterday somebody asked me, I talk with people on my Instagram, and there's this young guy saying, like, I've noticed something, the French society or the French government don't pay enough respect to their special force, so everybody's leaving, you know. I know a lot of friends who just moved to America because the guy need to shoot every week. It's like in our blood, man.
Right.
You know, and you are in a country where you can do that. So people get frustrated and people depressed and people, you know, do crazy thing. Especially when you spend 20 years in a special force, you can have a little PTSD.
Right.
You don't go back normal person, you know, it's not possible. So the only way for you to be good or to feel good is to keep doing what you like to do, not just to stop from it. Yeah.
Right. And so when you got towards the end of your career, you said you didn't have any involvement in combat for 2 years before you got out?
I end up in a cell, like close protection cell, because I'm qualified to be team leader, close protection team leader. So they send me in the cell to train the operators to become close protection operators. So for 2 years I've been doing that, but I still go overseas to protect people. But I stopped to do like a special ops mission with the team.
Okay, so then after you finished that, so then you retired after that, and you've been out, how long have you been retired now?
8 months right now.
Oh, so it's really fresh and brand new for you.
Yeah, it's brand new. Yeah.
So far, I know you feel like you might have had some issues with PTSD and things like that. How has all that been for you?
Listen, man. I'm lucky. I married a girl who really supported me about that. And if she won't be here, I mean, maybe if it was another woman, I'm sure she were already gone. And I have my family who support me. I have 4 kids, beautiful kids, which is I really do love. And I have all my family during like 1 year, you know, really involved in my PTSD. And I got a dog. That helped me a lot. I got this Labrador, you know, kind of Labrador.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, yeah, that's how I, when I'm getting really mad or really pissed off of nothing, just, you know, because you're getting mad for nothing. I had the dog, and the dog really calmed me down.
Right.
So my dog obviously is like a teammate, man.
So over here in the States, I would say this is probably the time where there's the most awareness for PTSD and veteran suicide. Is anything like that going on in France as far as people being aware and the government trying hard to figure out how to fix this issue?
Yeah, I mean, right now they are aware about it, but things are not well made. I have a friend who just died a few weeks ago. He hanged himself.
Oh, wow. Sorry to hear that.
Because he had a PTSD. But in France, PTSD is like, I'm not ashamed to tell people that I had PTSD. because to fight it, you need to understand it, you need to know it, and you need to accept that you have it, not to refuse it. I've been refusing the fact that I had PTSD for many years, and I always fall in the crying, and I don't understand what's going on, you know. So then I told myself, you're not okay, you are sick, and that's helped me a lot, you know. And in France, the system is not well made yet. People still look at you like you are a crazy person when you tell people that you have PTSD. They think PTSD is like for a guy who is not strong enough. Trust me, I'm a very strong guy. But when you see stuff, she thinks it's harder than you. And it's something that you can't fight. Like, sometimes as a man, you when you fight somebody, even a big guy, you fight a guy and you get crushed. But it's like, okay, I did it. I could fight the guy. I didn't run away. The problem with the PTSD, you can't fight it. You don't know how to do it. Nobody's trained to do it. And when you go to see a doctor, sometimes the doctor don't even understand what you have been through, man. So you are going to see somebody who need to treat you and have no clue what you are doing, where you have been. So right now they're starting like a new program where they send all the doctors to check the guy after 2 months or 3 months in the territory deployment. So they're doing stuff. It's starting, but they need to do more.
Right. Right. And I think, now with the medicine, modern medicine, and the ability of the combat medics and the doctors and the surgeons, more people are surviving wounds that they receive on the battlefield than ever before. So
yeah.
People come home, so more guys are surviving, basically, and people have brain damage from, you know, bombs or whatever, and shooting in tight spaces. So because of that, I think it created a large percentage of combat veterans who have some kind of issue with it. Not everyone has issues, but it's not uncommon or unnatural for a guy to have PTSD after serving for in that kind of job for so long, you know?
When you understand what's going on the ground, but you can't control it, you know, and you create like a link with the people you work with, like anywhere in any country you work, and then you understand the situation and what they said on TV just bullshit, you know.
Right.
And then when you go home, you try to explain to your family that this is not right. And I'm lucky, my wife always trusts me.
Right. Different. Were you wounded at all in combat during your service?
No. I'm lucky. I've never been wounded. I have a friend been wounded, but I have all my legs. I have nothing.
Right. Okay. And when you finally got into the special operations side, what was your specialty? Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, I can talk about it. So when I joined the Special Force, I was a sniper with a small caliber in my team. And I work with the team like we are the Special Recon vehicle, you know, the patrol vehicle. And also my team leader is a guy, he was specialized in the close protection. So he said, let's start close protection in our team. So we had these two specialties. We do close protection. Every year we go like twice in deployment. And we protect our official overseas or ambassadors or generals. So when I start to join the Special Force, I have a very good skills on close protection. And I have worked in many, many countries.
So then after that, you stayed as that as your specialty, close protection?
No. I my team is like we call it stick action special. So we do counterterrorism, but because you are specialized in the close protection, we can go like in a country, do our job, you know.
I see.
Our operator job, and then they said, "Oh, we need guys to protect somebody," so they just call us and we do it.
I see. I see. Okay. So in some units in the U.S., like they'll have a certain specialty. It could be like communications, medic, or something like that. And then they'll also go to like a sniper school and then come back and they'll be sniper certified. Is it similar in Special Forces?
It's similar. So every guy in the team sent to be like a. You have two demo guy. You have two snipers. We have two radio guy, you know. And we have one JTAC. Basically two, but most of the time you have one. And then you have two machine gunner. And you have the team leader and his deputy.
And you guys are all, is everyone like trained in like TCCC and things like that?
Sorry?
Is everyone trained in like bleeding control? Do you get like tourniquet use, kind of sort of basic combat medicine?
Yeah. Everybody do the first combat. We call it SC1. So in French, it's secours au combat, numéro un. So that means like the first level of we call it combat medic.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had to do the first level. So I can do perfusion. I can use tourniquet. I can stitch if I need to do it. I can. You learn the basics. That the first 30 seconds when somebody's wounded, it's the best time to react really good, you know. So more than 30% of people are saved because of that.
Right. Like the basic first aid and it's.
Yeah.
Right.
So we all have our specialties in the team.
Right. Okay. Cool. So you know, it was great having you on, brother. I do appreciate you doing this. You know, not too many Americans get to hear from a French Special Forces guy. So, you know, I know my audience is going to appreciate it. You know, I appreciate you coming on here again, and I want to say thank you for your service as well.
Oh, sir, I just want to say thank you, for you to have me here talking with you guys. I hope my English was not really hard to understand.
No, it's good.
I really appreciate it. And I love America, man. It's a great country. You guys have a great country. If it's not the biggest in the world. So keep it up and keep in touch, man.
Yeah, we'll do better.
Yeah.